From the studios of Radio Sai in Prashanti Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and you are listening to Love to Love. In ancient Greece, Socrates was reputed to hold knowledge in high esteem. Now, one day, an acquaintance met the great philosopher and said, "Do you know what I just heard about your friend?" "Now, hold on a minute," Socrates replied. "Before you talk to me about my friend, it might be a good idea to take a moment and filter what you are about to say. The first filter is that of truth. Have you made absolutely sure that what you're about to tell me is true?" "Well, no," the man said. "Actually, I just heard about it and..." "Well, all right," said Socrates. "So you don't really know if it is true or not. Now, let us try the second filter, the filter of goodness. Is what you're about to tell me about my friend something good?" "No, on the contrary..." So Socrates continued, "You want to tell me something bad about my friend, but you are not certain if it is true. Well, you may still pass the test though, because there is one filter left, the filter of usefulness. Is what you want to tell me today about my friend going to be useful for me?" Not really. "Well," concluded Socrates, "if what you want to tell me is neither true nor good, not even useful, why tell me at all?" Socrates wanted that any communication should pass either of the three tests. It has to be good or true or useful. This is called the triple filter test. Now, you know, everyone here in Radio Sai unconsciously do the triple filter test. So today I have lined up few stories that are true, that are good, and that are useful. And as usual, interspersed between these are some lovely songs of love that are guaranteed to warm your heart.
Hallelujah. 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 do I see? It looks like you, it looks like me. The world is full of many things, big and small, short and tall. Beyond space, beyond time, is where we live, eternal no time. Such a sight is here to say, love will take us all the way. Look at you, you radiate love and peace, ain't it great? There's only heaven, there is no hell. Love everyone and all will go well. Help everyone that you can, it will take you to the promised land. Such a sigh is here to say, love will take us all the way. It's so simple when you think it out, we're all the same in and out.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The first story is about a school. Now, this is no ordinary school because it is an unusual school in an unusual location and is run by an unusual teacher. Mr. Rajesh Kumar Sharma is a shopkeeper by profession but spends hours every morning teaching around 80 students from the poorest of the poor in India's capital city, New Delhi. Mr. Rajesh, a 40-plus-old father of three from Aligarh, was forced to drop out of college in his third year due to financial difficulties. Now, he didn't want other children to face the same difficulties he had, so he decided to start a free school. So he visited the construction of the Delhi Transit Station a few years ago and was disturbed by the sight of many children playing at the site instead of attending school. And when he questioned the parents working at the sites, they all said there were no schools in the vicinity and no one cared. So consequently, he opened an open-air classroom between pillars and beneath the tracks of the Delhi transit system known as the metro. As the Delhi metro from Yamuna Bank station rumbles on every day, something extraordinary takes place under its tracks. Children from neighboring slum gather here to let their imagination take over. Every few minutes a train passes above, the children would be attending the class unperturbed by the sounds. There are no chairs or tables, and the children sit on rolls of polystyrene foam placed on the rubble. And there are three rectangle patches of wall which are painted black, and they are used as blackboards. Anonymous donors have contributed uniforms, books, shoes and stationery for the children, as their parents cannot afford them. And one unnamed individual sends a bag full of biscuits and juice for the students every day so that it can act as an incentive for these children to turn up for their studies. So here it is, a great story which is true, good and useful. I hope it inspires you to serve your community in any small way possible. Dear listeners, don't ever underestimate the power of a motivated individual. As you will see, the first three stories are about what an individual can achieve if he or she has his or her heart in the right place.
I want to suggest something to you today. Life is a glorious experience and a true gift of God. So no matter what's going on, don't give up. Just simply keep on giving. Don't give up. Just keep on giving. Don't give up. Just pour. Don't give up. Just keep on living. The Lord will show you more. Don't give up. Just practice trusting. Don't give up. Just be. Don't give up, stop all that fuss and surrender, you will see. Life is lived one day at a time, life is all we need. Life's fulfilled once we see all is fine, so give and you will receive. Don't give up, just keep on living. Don't give up, just share. Don't give up, just keep on giving. Your good is in His care. Don't give up, just be happy. Don't give up, live now. Don't give up, follow what's lasting, you'll see exactly how. The universe is a perfect place, it knows just what to do. Our small part is so very simple, to know what is the truth. To simply give what He has given, a heart that is so pure. Don't give up, just keep on loving. Don't give up, be still. Don't give up, just keep on giving. You'll know His perfect will. The universe is a perfect place, it knows just what to do. Our small part is so very simple, to know what is the truth. So don't give up, be always grateful, you're blessed, so be assured. Don't Don't give up. Just keep on giving. You can do it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The next inspiring story comes from a national level volleyball player who was once traveling from Lucknow to Delhi in a train named Padmavati Express in India on April 11th, 2011. So she was boarding a train on general coach as she had to go to Delhi to give an exam. And as she boarded the fateful train, a gang of few thieves came and tried to snatch her chain. In the scuffle that followed, she was thrown from the running train. And as she was thrown outside the train, she fell on the nearby track, which had a train coming from the other direction, and this train ran over her legs. She was badly injured and suffered some serious injuries on the leg and the pelvic region. She was admitted in All India Institute of Medical Sciences for almost 4 months, and after that she was released. But the most tragic part of the incident was that she had to undergo an amputation of her right leg. In the 4 months that she spent at the hospital, she gained massive media coverage, and this added fuel to the already existing depression and frustration that she was going through, because she knew that her career as a volleyball player had come to an end. But did she lose all her hope and quit? No, she took inspiration from an Indian cricket player named Yuvraj Singh. She felt if he can recover from cancer, she too can recover from her ill fate. So she decided to climb Mount Everest. Well, at first, things seemed quite difficult, but she got excellent support from her parents, brother and coach, and she started training gradually. She then met the iconic Indian mountaineer, Pachendri Pal, who is the first Indian woman to scale Mount Everest, who was moved on seeing this girl's indomitable spirit. So she finally set out to scale Mount Everest and reached the top on 21st May 2013, and she had taken 52 days to reach the peak and finally became the first female amputee to climb Mount Everest. The message is simple, dear listeners. When life gives you lemons, make lemonade out of them. Don't let any situation bog you down.
Cries out and the fire is real. children by the hand and lead us to that promised land. Guide our steps with faith and love and guide our path from heaven above. Shine on, shine on, shine on, shine on.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The next story is a very unusual story. It is a story of a man who dedicated his life to protecting Mother Nature. A little more than 30 years ago, a teenager named Yadav Molai Payeng began burying seeds along a barren sandbar near his birthplace in northern India's Assam region to grow a refuge for wildlife. Not long after, he decided to dedicate his life to this endeavor. So he moved to the site where he could work full-time creating a lush new forest ecosystem. Incredibly, the spot today hosts a sprawling 1,360 acres of jungle that Payeng planted single-handedly. It all started way back in 1979 when floods washed a large number of snakes ashore on the sandbar. One day after the waters had receded, Payeng, who was 16 then, found the place dotted with dead reptiles. And this was the turning point of his life. The snakes died in the heat without any tree cover, and I sat down and wept over their lifeless forms. It was carnage. I alerted the forest department and asked them if they could grow trees there. They said nothing would grow there. Instead, they asked me to try growing bamboo. It was painful, but I did it. There was nobody to help me. Nobody was interested, says Payeng. Well, it's taken years for Payeng's remarkable dedication to planting to receive some well-deserved recognition internationally. It didn't take long for wildlife in the region to benefit from the manufactured forest. Demonstrating a keen understanding of ecological balance, Payeng even transplanted ants to his newly built ecosystem to enhance its natural harmony. And soon, the shadeless sandbar was transformed into a self-functioning environment where a large number of creatures could dwell. The forest called the Molai Woods now serves as a safe haven for numerous birds, deer, rhinos, elephants and tigers, species increasingly at risk from habitat loss. Despite the conspicuousness of Payeng's project, forestry officials in the region first learned about this new forest in 2008. And since then, they have become they have come to recognize his efforts as truly remarkable. Of course, the government of India conferred on Mr. Payeng the highest civilian honor, Padma Shri, this year in 2015. Well, sir, dear listeners, if a single man can convert more than 1,300 acres of land into lush green forest, imagine what a group of motivated, like-minded people can achieve.
Not born entangled in your spell, beguiled by visions, wandering.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The next story implores us to pause on our tracks to appreciate the beauty that is around us. Now, it was a chilly winter morning on the 12th of January 2007. Standing quietly in one corner of a busy subway station in Washington, D.C. was a violinist wearing a baseball cap and blue jeans playing his violin. Displaying amazing talent in playing solo violin, that violinist gave a truly incredible performance there for about 45 minutes. And this is what happened. During those 45 minutes, about 1,097 commuters passed through the station, with literally none of them paying any attention to that mind-soothing music from the violinist. However, during the third minute of the performance, a middle-aged man noticed that the violinist is performing there in that busy subway. So this man just paused there, looked at the violinist for a few seconds and then moved away to attend to his daily work. In the fourth minute, the violinist received the first tip of the day from a lady who had thrown $1 note into the violinist's till and quietly moved away without even noticing who the amazing violinist was. In the eighth minute, a man leaning against a pillar that is there a few yards away from the place where the violinist was performing started observing the violinist's performance. That man too quietly observed the violinist for a few seconds and later looked at his watch and then quickly walked away from the place without bothering to pay any further attention. In all, during his 45 minutes of scintillating performance there, the maximum attention he received was from a 3-year-old boy. This boy, with his eyes wide open, observed the violinist for about 3 minutes in a row. That was all the time the boy's mother allowed the boy to stay there, and later she forcibly took him away from the place, much against his desire to stay there for a few more minutes. All through this way, the boy just kept looking back at the violinist in the subway. A few more children of similar age too wanted to stay there and enjoy the amazing performance of the violinist, but were ruthlessly denied that priceless pleasure by their busy parents. During those 45 minutes of that great performance by the violinist, only 6 among the 1,097 commuters paused in front of the violinist for a few seconds and later briskly moved away. Only 20 out of those 1,097 commuters have donated some cash to the violinist, but they too were not bothered to know whom they were donating to. All that the violinist received for his 45 minutes of some mind-blowing musical performance there at the subway station was a meager $32. Now, there was an echoing silence around the subway station when the violinist suddenly stopped playing his violin. But none of the busy commuters passing through that station even noticed that sudden silence in the air, nor anyone applaud in appreciation to the violinist. But unfortunately, none of those busy commuters there knew that they just had watched one of the world's most talented and the amazing violinist named Joshua Bell, who was a child prodigy, and he was playing some of the most intricate set of music. None of these commuters there knew that the violin on which he played is a 400-year-old violin to own which the great Joshua Bell had paid a whopping $3.5 million. None of those 1,097 commuters there, they knew that just a night before the performance, in front of them at that busy subway station, the amazing Joshua Bell had given a live performance at a popular Boston theater to a packed house, with each ticket there sold for a minimum of $100. Finally, none of those subway commuters there knew that the great violinist Joshua Bell had performed in front of them at the busy subway station as part of a unique experiment Gene Weingarten of Washington Post was conducting to measure the exact amount of time people actually spend to pay attention to such beautiful things happening in and around them on a busy day. There were many hidden cameras there in the subway station capturing each and every moment of Joshua Bell's performance and the movement of the commuters there in the subway. But neither the commuters nor the great Joshua knew about it. Later, when Gene Weingarten presented these subway findings in his book, The Fiddler in the Subway, the book won him a well-deserved Pulitzer Prize. Well, dear listeners, our life is always about many small things and little pleasures, which may seem very meaningless and impractical when we are busy pursuing our goals. However, by the time we reach our goals and accomplish our tasks, it'll be too late for us to realize what we have thus far lost in our life. If we always keep the eyes of our mind wide open, then there are many amazing things in this beautiful world waiting to give us enough reasons to smile, and music is certainly one of them.
The light of God is who I am.
the light of God is the love in my heart. The light of God is the peace in my mind. The light of God is the joy of my soul. The light of God is the light of God is the truth of my being. The light of God is the good I'm receiving. The light of God is all I am seeking. The light of God is the light of God is the truth of my being. The light of God is the good I'm receiving. The light of God is all I am seeking. The light of God is
Welcome back, dear listeners. Now let us take a look at a few stories close to home, related to our most beloved Swami. Now here is an amazing experience of Mrs. Phyllis Crystal. Let us listen to this beautiful story in her own words as she narrated it to Radio Sai. She says, "It was the worst nightmare anyone midair could ever go through, with the most menacing looking hijackers staring down at them The horrified and helpless passengers watched the dance of their imminent end being played out right before their very eyes. Armed to the teeth, the hijackers had strewn broken liquor and perfume bottles along the aisle to ensure that when they did light the fire, the plane would burn brilliantly. Meanwhile, they were running out of fuel and had been denied landing at any of the European cities the flight was hovering over. The hijackers had originally hoped to land in Athens, Greece. They were seeking the release of two of their compatriots imprisoned there for a former similar misadventure. Their ultimatum to the passengers hardly required any translation from Arabic to English. Their intent was clear enough. With their original plan thwarted, they planned to blow up the plane load of passengers over the North Sea. The year was 1974, and caught in the thick of this horrifying episode were the American couple, Mr. Sidney Crystal, a prominent Los Angeles attorney, and his wife, Mrs. Phyllis Crystal, a psychotherapist. The Crystals were returning home from India after a visit to Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. Now, reliving that dreadful moment, Mrs. Phyllis Crystal recalls, and she says, one of the hijackers was smoking a cigarette which was hanging out of his mouth. Now, Sidney, my husband being a lawyer, said, we know he is going to blow up the plane here if that cigarette drops on any of this ammunition. Now, you know, we have had a very good and long life together. You're going to have to understand that you will not survive and you will not see your daughters again. And at that moment, out of my mouth came the most astonishing sentence. I said, don't be so foolish. We're going to survive. And I don't know where it came from. I then remembered Baba's room when we were in Dharmakshetra, Baba's residence in Mumbai. So I instantly visualized it again and really concentrated on that room and started to say in my very excited English accent, Baba, 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 please help. And the next moment, the most astonishing thing came into my mind. It was as if his voice was clearly heard. And he said, he meaning Swami said, send love to them. And I remember saying, are you crazy? Have you looked at their faces? Have you seen that they want to kill us and you expect me to send them love? And the next thing that came to my mind, which was again very clear, was that I should be able to send his love because only Swami could see the God even in the hijackers. I started to visualize Swami in his room in Dharmakshetra. I was breathing in his love so consciously as I had never done before, and then I just directed it to the hijackers. As I did it, they got more and more nervous. They were trembling. They dropped the ammunition. One man dropped the cigarette and immediately put it out. Through the force of this invisible energy that Phyllis Crystal was transmitting to the hijackers, the situation on the troubled flight began to change dramatically. The evildoers appeared visibly weakened in their resolve. Confessing her own shock at the effectiveness of the simple guidance she had received, she said, I was so astonished. I was doing what I was told to do, but I suppose I didn't realize that it would really work. And so I was really quite surprised. But it was immediate. The one that was smoking started to tremble. And the entire atmosphere was changing rapidly. After hours of undergoing horrific ordeal, the airplane was allowed to land at Amsterdam, and all the passengers had to slide down the emergency chute for their dear lives, leaving behind all their belongings, including passports, shoes, and jackets. And within minutes, the hijackers set the plane ablaze. And they were arrested shortly thereafter. Now, later the same year, when Phyllis Crystal and Sidney Crystal were back in India to see Bhagwan, he confirmed his direct intervention in the situation. Phyllis explained, as soon as we got there, Swami came to us and I started to thank him. And he interrupted me saying, yes, I heard you. And he mimicked my voice in a very English accent. It was historical and we laughed so much because Baba was mimicking me in English accent and it was very, very sweet. He invited us for lunch and then he gave us a quick interview. And when we were with him, he explained what had happened. From what I understood, the most important thing he said was that the entire plane loaded with people was saved because the plane was filled with his love. So there it is, dear listeners. Love is the answer, whatever the question is. Welcome back, dear listeners. The next story is a beautiful experience of one of Swami's students where he learned the true meaning of the word prayer. So here is Brother Sundar Iyer narrating the story for us.
I learned the difference between asking and praying, and I want to share that perspective because it's very important. I often ask people, when you pray, do you ask something? And if you're asking, then is that asking praying? And one of the reasons why most of us don't get what we ask for answered is because we are asking and not praying. And I'm not merely playing with two different words, but I think for me prayer is very different from asking something. And when you're asking, you're just asking. Mm-hmm. When you're praying, you're not asking. For somebody who is spiritually evolved would probably can understand this, but as a youngster, for me, I had learned this firsthand. And it was such a powerful experience that taught me what true prayer really is, and how you sit in front of your God, your chosen deity, whom you ascribe omniscience, you ascribe omnipresence, you ascribe omnipotence and everything. And then what do you do then? If he knows everything, then what am I going to ask? Isn't it an insult to tell him that I need something? The mother knows when the child is hungry. She doesn't even wait for the baby to cry because she knows exactly when the feeding time is. When, you know, she watches over the baby, even when the baby sleeps. And when you ascribe that quality to God, then what do? Isn't it insulting for us to say, Swami, I need this. Swami, I want that. Swami, please help me cure him or her or me. And for me, that's a very powerful lesson. And this is how I learned it. He came to the hostel one evening and spoke about, on a Sunday, and spoke about the Soham Pranayama. Very rarely does Swami speak about Pranayama and Mantra or Yoga. So that was one of the most beautiful discourses of Swami, where he expounded the meaning of Soham. And he said, why is Soham such a powerful mantra? Because the So means that is coming into you as you breathe in, and the Hum, that is you, I, is going away as you breathe out. So that is coming in, I is going out. That is coming in, I is going out. So, breathe in, Hum, breathe out. I think it's a very profound explanation. It's very simplistic in nature, but he said when you think of it every time, the ego just, every time you breathe out, breathe away yourself out and allow the infinity to come in. I thought that was a very powerful thing. And to me, and I haven't read about this perception of Soham anywhere else in the world, honestly. Anyway, so I heard this and I said, okay, I'm going to practice Soham. Because I was so much into yoga by then, every single thing I would take and practice. And for some reason, I thought if I do this, maybe Swami would give me an indication that I'm on the right path. I was clinging to every indication and every blessing and spiritual blessing Swami was giving. So for me, I was trying, I said, okay, what if I practice Soham now every day? And let's see, how do I make Swami react to this? Sunday afternoon, I said, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is when my class goes for darshan. Okay? And because you see all the boys coming in for darshan every day. But it's not the same boy standing in the first few lines. There are different grade boys get their opportunity. So it's Monday is the commerce of the first year graduate boys, the second year. So every week, you know, you go in turns. So we knew that our class was, this was somewhere much later in the 80s, after Swami's room and all that, much later. So I knew my class was going in on a Wednesday. So I said, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday if I practice, on a Thursday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday if I practice 3 days, Thursday I get to stand first in the line and I go and sit first in the row. I'm sure he's going to give me an indication that my prayers were reached him. So for some reason I thought I was doing this to please him, not realizing that we do most of these spiritual pursuits for our own sake. We don't say, oh Baba, I've been praying for you so long, why is this happening? You didn't do it for him, you do it for your own self. But at that point I thought I'm going to do it to please him. So the next 3 days, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, I seriously, very ardently practiced the Soham Pranayama. I kept breathing in, so breathing out, Hum. I was hardly paying attention in my classes. The nights I would hardly sleep. I would literally an austere tapas, if you will, I did for those 3 days. Thinking on the fourth day, he's going to show me something. A real sign that I did it. And I wanted that from him. Okay. So Thursday evening I came first in the line, went right there, sat right next to the birthday boy. The birthday boy usually sits right next to the front pillar, you know, if you remember. And then I was sitting right next to him. And so even before the darshan began, I was so full of myself. I said, you know what, Baba, I don't want any little actions here and there. Just looking at me and all is not going to be enough. Or coming and standing in front of me is not going to be enough. Because that way I can touch your feet. That's not a sign. I want something out of the world. Now this is asking, literally.
Yeah.
Okay. I want something out of the world. You have to show me something out of the world that I did the sadhana and you accepted it. So I wasn't ready to take just a look or a smile or a nod or, you know, I said, give me something. I don't know what it is. I want something. I practiced so hard for the last 3 days. Come on, you have to do this. He comes up for darshan, comes to the birthday boys, and he picks up the chocolate and throws it around. Not one falls on me. And he looks around and starts walking out for his darshan. And for me, the first thing was, okay, not even look. He kind of completely ignored me and he walked away. He finished the ladies' side, he was coming down the gents' side, and I knew that darshan is kind of getting over. He's picked up people for interview. So, in all that commotion in my mind, I was thinking, okay, Swami, okay, let's have a compromise. Maybe you can just look at me and smile at me. How about a smile? Honestly, this is exactly what is going in my head. okay, Swami, at least just give me a smile. I know you're busy, you've got people for interview, you're going to go in. The reason why I was panicking was, as soon as the darshan gets over, I sing bhajans, so I have to get up and go into the bhajan hall. And once I go into the bhajan hall, there is no telling that Swami is going to come and talk, because the bhajan starts and then Swami comes in just for the aarti and walks away. This is the only chance where physically there could be some communication taking place. So he comes and he starts his last few steps at the end of the darshan, and I'm looking at him and he completely ignored me. And he came and stood right in front of me. And then he spoke to a boy, a couple of rows behind, asking, where did you come from? And he told the VIPs, oh, so-and-so has come from there. Oh, call your parents. So the boy gets up and looks for his dad, and he's calling his mom and dad. All the time, Baba is here in front. And now this is where the true lesson began, because I'm looking at Baba, staring at him. And now I'm saying, okay, Baba, forget smile, forget everything. Just look down at me. Come on, can't you just look down at me? And I'm staring with fiery eyes, sitting straight. Now, it doesn't need a god to know somebody sitting down and staring at you. You and I do that. You walk in a shopping mall, if somebody is looking at you and wonder, why is this so-and-so staring at me? It doesn't need to be divine. So, it would have taken him a second just to look down, but he didn't. And all the time I was screaming, the distance was so close, less than 3 or 4 feet between me and Swami's face. I could literally see through his nostrils, was standing so close. He was talking to that boy, waiting for the boy to call his parents. And all the time my head was bursting with this. Swami, please, 3 days. I didn't speak to anyone. I was practicing soham. You have to look down and acknowledge. Please acknowledge. Swami, can't you hear me? I mean, you are right in front of me. Can't you hear me? You have done this before. You have to do it now. There was absolutely stoic face with Swami, as far as I remember. There was no expression at all. And then he turned around, and to my dismay, he walked, picked up the people for interview room. And one by one they're going. I'm like, Swami, just one glance, one little glance. I've come down to that much now. He went and he started shutting the interview room door. And usually, even before he shuts, he kind of peeps at the boys and then shuts the door. Sometimes he gives a loving smile, or he just mocks a face or shuts the door. Things devotees don't see usually. But I was hoping at least a look before he shuts the door. He did. He went and shut the door. And I was left stranded right there. At that moment, I remember that moment, suddenly everything went shh. From all that screaming and yelling at Swami in my head, it became completely silent. And tears were almost welling up my eyes with, it's over. I just thought it was over. That's it. I have to go now to the bhajan hall. 3, 4, 5 seconds passed. Probably 10 seconds, I don't know. And then suddenly the door, the noise came, and all the devotees were getting up. Suddenly there was a hush. I looked around, and I was about to get up because I had to go into the bhajan hall. And then suddenly there was a hush. I looked and I saw the interview room door open. And by this time the birthday boy had got up and gone away. So I moved into that corner pillar just for the 2 minutes to ease myself and get up and go. He comes out. Apparently one of the ladies had not still come for the interview. Mm-hmm. Now always God's actions are very subtle. Okay. So he comes out and he says, hey, lazy, come on. And so now that woman gets up and starts walking to the interview room. And at this point now I'm sitting under Swami's feet. My mind is completely blank. Go ahead.
What?
He's standing there. There's a small step up and I'm standing and sitting down. He's standing right just outside the interview room door. And he's calling the lady and they're coming and she's coming to the interview room. And Swami is telling, yeah, lazy, lazy and all. He's letting her in. And then just before he followed her back into the interview room, it took only a second. And by then I was completely quiet. I was just watching. My mind was completely tired, physically, spiritually. I was exhausted after all that praying, quote unquote. I was just watching. He turned around. He had materialized vibhuti inside the interview room. So his fingertips were full of vibhuti. So he turned around, not a word, but he turned around and put that vibhuti on my forehead. Walked into the room and shut the door.
You must have just died.
I'm still alive, aren't I?
I don't know.
I take home a fantastic message from that. When we think we are praying, we are so full of ourselves and what we want and what has to happen to us that our prayers never reaches the divine source within us. It doesn't. And I think all the emotions and the hysteria that was going on in my head, I thought was prayer, was actually all the chaos and the static that I was creating, a strong field for God to even answer. It wasn't even reaching Him, though physically He was inches away from me. Yet, when my mind silenced itself, He knew exactly what I wanted, and the answer was right there. And to me, I take that even today, even in my most intense moments of life, when I'm so tempted to pray, I silence myself. Because I think the Divine Mother knows your innermost desire. And the only thing that stops that from materializing is us. It's not the Divine. It's us. And God says, Swami says, God's light, grace is like sunlight. It's all there for you. You have to only open the door. You have shut the door. And by our praying and asking, whether it's for healing, me or somebody else, whatever it is, it's asking. If we are learning to accept it in complete silence, I think our innermost desires will automatically manifest.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The time in the studios is 3:17 p.m. and it is almost time for me to conclude. I hope you all enjoyed the stories that were narrated today and the beautiful music that accompanied it. Your feedback is welcome. Please write to listener@radiosci.org. Well, before I sign off, let's do one last story and one last song. So this beautiful story is narrated by Mrs. Gita Mohan Ram. And this story is about, again, about our dearest Swami's omnipresence and omniscience. So here is Mrs. Gita Mohan Ram with her story.
But you see, we all sing, I like this bhajan. Many, many years ago, Swami used to sing this. Anandame Sai Namamo, Adbhutame Sai Gitamo, Akhandame Jyotirmayame, Sundarame Sai Rupamo. So beautiful is Sai's name, so beautiful is his story, so beautiful is his form, and so wonderful and marvelous are his stories. I asked him some years ago, Swami, same experiences. People always ask me to speak only of experiences, Swami. Same thing, how many times shall I go on speaking? Is it enough now? Shall I stop now? Bhagavatam vinte bhagavatam. He said, if you listen to the Bhagavatam, we become better. Bhagavatam is nothing but Swami's story, the sweet story of Swami. You see, a year ago, that happened many years ago, I went to a talk once in a retreat, and somebody said, you know, you are always telling us such sweet stories about Swami many, many years ago. Have you any experienced anything recently? They asked me. I said, Swami, this is also one test. What have I experienced recently? But you see, a year ago, I went to Atlanta, a year and a half ago. They had asked me, there was a one-day retreat in Atlanta. And they asked me to speak. I did not know that I was going there. I was sitting in Puttaparthi in the darshan. And Swami came and said, Atlanta people brought me their program. He said, I told them to invite you, you go there, he told me. So they were asked to invite me. I came back here. They called me and said, Swami has asked us, please can you come? So I actually went to Atlanta. You see how Swami answers everybody's prayers. We never know how he answers. I went there and I spoke as usual. They had asked me to speak on my experiences with Swami again. And I spoke, and at the end of the talk, there was a lot of people in that retreat. And there was one couple, an African-American couple, standing a little away from me. And they were waiting for a long time to talk to me. There were so many people all surrounding me. And I finished and I kept looking at them and I said, 1 minute I will talk to you, 1 minute. And time went by. Then after almost 20 minutes they came and they just said, Sai Ram, thank you, Sai Ram, thank you. That's all they kept saying. I said, you're welcome, nice to meet you. That's all, they didn't say anything more. Sai Ram, thank you. Then after that, they took me to some Sai devotee's home where they had a dinner that night. The people who had organized there, it was in a very beautiful church, so they said we will clear up the altar and everything and we will come there. As soon as they all came after removing the altar and everything, they took another 20 minutes to come. They came and one of the devotees who had organized is an old student of Swami's school who I know from Bangalore many, many years. They are also very old devotees of Swami. He came and he said to me in Kannada, jokingly, he said, Gita, in Kannada, he said, Yeneno language ella barthe gottillilla. I didn't know that you knew so many languages, he said. So I said, what language? What are you talking about? He said, do you remember that African couple who were standing there? I said, yes, they were standing for a long time, but the only thing they said to me was, thank you, thank you. I felt very bad that I made them wait so long. He said, they said only thank you to you because they didn't know how to speak English. He said, maybe that's why they didn't talk to me. He said, no, but listen to this funny thing. We all laughed that day. They came up to me with another friend of theirs who knows French. And they came and introduced themselves. They said they are from the country of Togo. And they came to us when we were clearing the altar and said, through the translator, they said, thank you very much for organizing a speaker who could speak French so well. So these people said, which speaker are you talking about? He said, the lady who just spoke, she spoke in French so well. Thank you very much. So they thought that there's something wrong with this couple, you know. He said, she didn't speak in French, she spoke in English. What are you talking about? They said, no, you had the PowerPoint. They had some Swami's pictures going on while I was speaking, which was not a part of my talk. They had just some video going on there. So they said, no, we thought that she had, you were translating her talk into English. They said, no, no, she spoke in French. What are you all talking about? Then this couple said that we just moved from Togo to the US. We don't have a job. We have come here. We are looking for a job. We are in very difficult circumstances. But we have been Sai devotees for the past 8 years. And in Togo, there was a beautiful Sai center. And all the proceedings go on in French. So we were able to enjoy Swami's songs and Swami's leelas so beautifully there. But once we came to the US, everything goes on here in English. We could not understand anyone. We don't speak the language. We don't know anyone. We were feeling very lonely. Few weeks ago, we had been praying to Swami, saying, Swami, at least introduce us to somebody who knows French. We want to at least get to know where the Sai Center is. Then suddenly, somebody called and said that there is a one-day retreat in Atlanta. There is a lady speaking, why don't you go there? We said we can't understand any lady speaking because she will speak in English and we don't understand English. So they said, no, no, but the bhajan will be very good. Why don't you go and at least enjoy the bhajan? It doesn't matter if you don't understand what she says. So they thought it has been so long since we came away from our Sai center in Africa. Let us go and at least enjoy the bhajan. But we came and sat and the lady narrated Swami's story so beautifully in French. We were overjoyed. So again this person, president of the center, said she did not speak in French. What did she say? So they narrated all the experiences that I had spoken. So then he was really surprised. He said, okay, somehow you understood. So he came to the house and said, Geeta, you know, the couple thought that you spoke in French. So I laughed and said, oh, you know, Swami has his own ways. I'm finding it hard even to speak in English now. Where did I speak in French? You know, we just joked, did not take it seriously at all. I came back to a place, I didn't give it another thought. This was I had come back from India. I had gone to Atlanta in the month of September. The following year, in July, I went back to Puttaparthi last year. When I went there, Swami talked to me. At that time, he said, where did you go and speak? I said, Swami, I spoke in Atlanta last year, which you had told me to go there. So he said, yes, yes, your French talk was very good. I said, Swami, what? Swami, somebody said that they could understand in French. He said, yes, it has nothing to do with you. You see, our ego, we have to keep it so small, so small, so small. It has nothing to do with us. What he gives us is his grace. He said, it had nothing to do with you. That couple, for 1 year, they have been praying to hear Swami's stories, to listen to Swami's songs, to listen to Swami's leelas ever since they left their country. They were feeling so lonely, they felt that they had lost out on their involvement in the Sai Center. They had been praying and praying. So they came there. They had to hear my stories. They heard in French, it had nothing to do with you. You see, Adbhutame, Sai Bhutam, how marvelous. How marvelous are his deeds. We are just small little beings that float around thinking that we do so many things. But he can convert our language into any language that he wants. He can convert us into anything that he wants. But the only thing I think that we have to constantly remember that he is with us at all times.